You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision. Thank you for joining us for Food and Stuff, read by Gretchen Miller, featuring Smitten Kitchen. Today we're going to start off with a recipe for winter squash pancakes with crispy sage and brown butter. There comes times in every cookbook author's life that they have a very specific kind of gift to bestow on unsuspecting others. Tasty, deeply loved dishes that were dismissed, ejected, left homeless in the editorial process because they didn't make the cut. The reasons may be myriad. The ingredient, format, or flavor felt redundant with another dish, or, as happened here, something else about it gnawed at me until I decided it was best to move on without it. I believe we call these rejects. I, however, prefer to call them displacements. And I'm not even sad because this means I get to share it with you sooner. These are my most favorite dinner pancake to date, and I love them as endlessly when I made them for the first time 2 years ago, as I did when I revisited them last weekend. Here you use any roasted mashed winter squash. I've made this with both kabocha and butternut, but you can use whatever you can have or can get, and you whisk it into a quick, thick batter with sour cream or buttermilk, flour, eggs, and then instead of the predictable sugar and pumpkin spice, we add salt, pepper, and Gruyere or Parmesan, if you're feeling it. No surprise here, we always are. And spoon them into a frying pan, just like you were making pancakes on a Saturday morning, if you're the sort of person who does such things. These look beautiful. Not that anyone asked the details, but this is where I got stuck. Do we serve them with a yogurt sauce? Some sort of salsa verde? Probably, but they were so mellow, I wasn't sure that they needed anything so sharp. So I started Googling savory squash pancakes, and all the way at the bottom of the second page of results, I discovered that someone, the lovely and dangerous Mimi Thorison, had gotten to my pancake idea first. And I was very sad because I like to believe every thought that comes into my head is a special butterfly or a unique snowflake, even when the evidence to the contrary mounts. And then right after I was sad, I realized that the recipe had done something that mine had not. It stuck the landing. Thorison has you finish the pancakes with a bit of sage crisped in brown butter that you pour over the pancakes, and it is everything, the perfect coda. It's also a little crazy. Yes, we're just going to pour some butter over these pancakes like we've never heard of arteries. But I find that very little goes a long way, and also that there's absolutely nothing else on top that will be half as unforgettable. So I had coffee with Mimi, her husband, and two of their gorgeous kids a couple of years ago. And by the end of the hour, I was so charmed. The spell they cast is so pervasive. I was 100% ready to buy a farmhouse in France. Actually, I still cannot remember why we have not. Here's the recipe: winter squash pancakes with crispy sage and brown butter. This serves 12 pancakes. It can serve 3 as a main or 4 to 6 as a side. Time, 15 minutes once the squash is cooked. I prefer my own winter squash pancake, a little more squash, less flour, and an additional egg to help it set the recipe, but the crispy sage brown butter is inspired by a Mimi Thorison version. Thorison recommends 5+ tablespoons of butter, but I found that even 2 or even 2-ish makes a finish that trickles over the side of the stack just enough that you can taste and enjoy it, but not drown in richness. Definitely adjust to your taste. Finally, I can just about guarantee that you will not regret if you double this recipe. The pancakes keep well in the fridge and can also be frozen. For the pancakes, you'll need 1 cup of roasted and mashed winter squash, 1/3 cup yogurt or sour cream, 2 large eggs, 1/2 cup of finely grated Gruyere, Comté, or Parmesan cheese, 3/4 teaspoon of fine sea or table salt, a few grinds of black pepper, 1 teaspoon of baking powder, 1 cup of all-purpose flour, and butter or olive oil for the frying pan. To finish, you'll need 2 to 3 tablespoons of butter, a pinch or two of salt, and a few fresh sage leaves. In a large bowl, you're going to whisk the squash, yogurt, eggs, cheese, salt, pepper, and baking powder until smooth. Add the flour and stir until just combined. The batter will be thick. Heat a large frying pan over medium-low to medium heat. Coat the bottom with butter or olive oil or a combination thereof, and spoon in the pancake batter a heaped soup spoon or scant 1/4 cup at a time. Press the back of the batter mound to flatten the pancake slightly and cook until golden brown underneath. Flip and then cook until the color of golden brown is on the second side. And if this is happening very fast, you want to lower your heat. If you're worried that the pancakes have not cooked in the center, you can finish them for 10 minutes in a 250-degree oven. You can also keep your pancakes warm there until needed. So I like that idea. Repeat all of this with the remaining batter. To finish, you're going to wipe out the frying pan and place the butter, a pinch or two of salt, and sage leaves back in it, heat over medium. The sage leaves will crisp and the butter will brown in a minute or two, so keep a close watch on it. Pour the leaves and the butter over the pancakes and quickly understand why you will never have them any other way. To roast the squash for butternut or kabocha, I have the squash and scoop out the seeds and roast it face down on an oiled baking sheet that I've sprinkled with coarse salt at 375 degrees for 40 to 50 minutes until tender. I get about 2 cups of mashed squash from 1 2-pound, if that's a small to medium whole squash. If yours is already peeled and in, say, 1-inch chunks, it will likely be tender in just 25 minutes. Enjoy. Next, simple eggplant parmesan. This is one of my favorite things. Last year, I told you that despite it being the opposite of eggplant season, I crave our eggplant parmesan incessantly each winter. I mean, who doesn't want an aromatic, cheese stretchy, cozy casserole of ziti-like flavors, but without the heaviness of the pasta sometimes, right? What this post omitted was my recipe, which was kind of rude. The truth is that I wasn't completely comfortable sharing the recipe because it's not a true eggplant parmesan, or so I believed. It's not breaded, it's not fried, and there's definitely no ricotta. Even the title of the recipe, as it was saved on my computer, was self-conscious. Not really, in parentheses, eggplant parmesan. So what changed? Going to Italy this summer, we ordered eggplant parmesan, parmigiana de melanzane, almost every time we saw it on the menu. And do you know what would come out? A dish that looked like this. No breading, no crumbs, no ricotta. It made more sense when I read about the history of the dish from Amico Davies, which I'll simply link to rather than poorly summarize. It's fascinating. But it also gave me the nudge to finally spring the recipe from my kitchen to yours. And the link to the history is in smittenkitchen.com. I think this recipe is heavenly. Thick slices of fresh eggplant are salted, dabbed dry, and roasted in a generous application of olive oil at high heat until deeply brown on both sides. Almost like fried, but without the oil spatters and spread of paper towels to drain the grease. While they roast, you make a simple tomato sauce on the stove with onion, garlic, and pepper flakes softened in olive oil. You fan the slices of eggplant in a dish with sauce under and over them and cover it with a heap of mozzarella and parmesan and bake it until blistered, cozy, and absolutely spoonable with stretches of cheese trying to drag each spoonful back to the pan. Spoiler, it will fail, you will win. Here's the recipe, simple eggplant parmesan. This serves 4 to 6, takes 2 hours, mostly hands off, and the source is Smitten Kitchen. You'll need 2 pounds of eggplant cut into generous 1/2-inch slices, kosher salt, olive oil, freshly ground black pepper, 1 small onion finely chopped, 3 garlic cloves minced, 1/4 teaspoon of red pepper flakes, 1 20 28-ounce can of whole tomatoes. Again, that's one 28-ounce can of whole tomatoes, 1 teaspoon of dried oregano, handful of fresh basil leaves, roughly chopped, 1/2 cup of finely grated Parmesan or Pecorino cheese, and 8 ounces of grated or thinly sliced mozzarella. To prepare the eggplant, you're going to arrange the eggplant slices on a large half-sheet baking pan in one layer. Sprinkle with about 2 teaspoons of kosher salt and set aside for 30 minutes. Then you're going to heat your oven to 425 degrees Fahrenheit. Roast the eggplant. Transfer the eggplant slices to paper towels and blot them off as much of the excess water as possible. And then dry the baking sheet too and coat it with 3 tablespoons of olive oil and sprinkle the oil with several grounds of black pepper. Arrange the eggplant slices in one layer. Drizzle with 2 more tablespoons of oil and more grinds of black pepper and roast until nicely browned underneath, about 20 to 25 minutes. Use a thin spatula to turn the eggplant slices over and roast until browned underneath on the second side, another 10 minutes. It's okay if they're not cooked through yet. You're going to reduce your oven temperature to 375 degrees Fahrenheit. Meanwhile, you're going to make the sauce. While the eggplant roasts, open your can of tomatoes and use kitchen shears or very well-washed scissors to chop the tomatoes into small bits. Heat 2 tablespoons of olive oil in a medium-large saucepan over medium-high heat. Once it's hot, add onion and cook until it softens about 8 minutes. Add garlic and pepper flakes and cook another minute. Add tomatoes, beware the splatter, oregano, and season with 1 teaspoon of salt plus more to taste. Let the mixture simmer over low heat for about 10 minutes, stirring occasionally. If you'd like the sauce smoother than it is now, you can mash the tomatoes further with a potato masher as it cooks, or use an immersion blender for completely smooth sauce. Stir in the basil and then taste the sauce and adjust salt and pepper to your taste. Then you're going to assemble. In a 1.5 to 2 quart baking dish holding 6 to 8 cups, you're going to spoon about 1/2 cup of the sauce and then arrange about 1/2 of the eggplant slices slightly overlapped in one layer. Spoon another 1/2 cup of sauce over it and spread it evenly, and then arrange the remaining eggplant slices, then ladle more sauce over it so it's as saucy as you like. You can keep unused sauce in the fridge for another day. It will keep for 4 to 5 days. Sprinkle the top with mozzarella and Parmesan. Bake for 30 minutes until the cheese has melted and the sauce is bubbling all over. For more color on top, you can run it briefly under your oven's broiler. To serve, once it's baked, let the eggplant Parmesan rest at room temperature, if you can bear it, for 15 minutes before digging in. This helps the ingredients settle and come together more. It's not mandatory, but this is excellent with a side of garlic bread. As far as doing ahead, eggplant Parmesan keeps fantastically in the fridge for up to 5 days. You're going to rewarm it in a 350-degree oven, covered for the first half of the time for about 25 to 30 minutes. You can also freeze it well wrapped for a few months. Sounds delicious. Next, another favorite of mine, spanakopita. I finally conquered my fear of making spanakopita, the Greek savory spinach and feta pie, and yes, this means I'm going to tell you all about it. It took me so long because, however pathetically, I find phyllo, the thin dough used to produce the flaky layers in many Middle Eastern and Balkan pastries, stressful. The tissue-like sheets can dry into crumbles in what feels like seconds. Having to brush each layer with butter or oil before using it is challenging in a small kitchen, and a lot of work in any size. Over the years, I've auditioned many spanakopita-ish pies that allow me to hedge a bit on the phyllo. Triangles, it's only 1 sheet at a time, made it less scary. Spirals, ditto with 1 sheet. This recipe is in Smitten Kitchen every day. Galettes, using a pie-like dough, and even skillets, where I just messily crumbled some phyllo on top. All were good, None were this. This is exact spanakopita that I crave, more doable than I thought possible. So what changed? Well, TikTok, my favorite diversion. I've spent the last few weeks working on the copy edits for my next cookbook, coming this fall. I can't wait to tell you more about it. But obviously, this also means that I would scroll TikTok to rest my brain a little bit between detangling gram and grammar inconsistencies. A spanakopita video from Eat Like Greek with Julie, that's on TikTok or Instagram or YouTube, appeared, and it's all that I've thought about since. I probably watched it 24 times over the next 2 weeks. The moment my edits were in, I went straight to the kitchen to make it. It did not disappoint, not even a tiny little bit. Five things were different about this spanakopita than any that I've made before. The sheets are not brushed individually, painstakingly with oil. You just drizzle it generously over every sheet or two right in the pan. Also, there's no stovetop step. The onion goes in raw, yet it's not crunchy or sharp in the pie. If you've ever cooked with fresh spinach, then you know that there's a lot of water in it. And most recipes begin with a wilt and then a ring step. This did not. I fully expected it to slice into a puddle of pie, and this did not happen. It wasn't even soggy. Do not ask me to explain the science of it. Just enjoy the freedom from this step. You can watch some TikToks with the time that you save. We mix this with our hands, and it's better off for it. I'm sorry for the word choice, but squishing everything together gets the feta evenly over every spinach or every leaf of spinach while softening everything. You start with an unwieldy amount of spinach and end up with a tightened mixture ready to bake. Just do it. The recipe uses a mix of flat and scrunched phyllo sheets for the most texture, including a layer in the middle of the spinach. Scrunching is fun. The pastry looks like rumpled bed sheets beckoning a nap, which is an energy that speaks to me on this icy January week. We cut the pie into squares before we bake it. I've seen this technique for baklava, but never spanakopita, but it's brilliant here for the same reasons. You won't shatter the pastry as you serve it. Plus, the top ends up much more dramatic and crunchy, and the center seems to cook more evenly. And it allows for more evaporation, thus less potential sogging. The result is the best spanakopita that I've ever eaten and certainly made. I hope you feel equally triumphant when you pull it off at home. Here's the recipe for spanakopita. Serves 12 to 16, but you will have no trouble eating two. Time, 30 to 45 minutes. Prep, 45 to 60 minutes to bake. Source, it's adapted from Eat Like Greek with Julie. You'll need 1 1/4 pounds of baby spinach, roughly chopped, 1 cup of red onion, finely chopped, 6 to 8 scallions, thinly sliced, 2 cloves of garlic, minced, 1/3 cup of chopped fresh dill, or more to taste, 1/3 cup of fresh mint, or more to taste, 1/2 cup of chopped fresh parsley, 3/4 pounds of feta, drained and crumbled, 1 large egg, and then kosher salt and freshly ground black pepper. You need 1 pound or package of phyllo pastry, defrosted, and olive oil. Heat your oven to 375 degrees Fahrenheit. In your largest bowl, place spinach, onions, scallion, garlic, herbs, and feta. Use your freshly washed, of course, hands to mix everything together, truly squeezing the feta into the other ingredients and breaking up the spinach a little more as you do. I promise it's fun. When the ingredients are tightly mixed, taste a pinch and add salt and pepper as needed to season it well. I use 1.5 teaspoons of kosher salt and many grinds of black pepper. Add the egg and mix it until it disappears into the spinach. Unwrap and unroll your phyllo so it's in a flat pile and ready to use. I do not keep it covered with a cloth because we will use it fast. Coat a 12-inch cast iron skillet or equivalent pan. You can use a 12-inch cake pan or a 9x13-inch baking dish. Coat that generously with olive oil. You are going to want to be generous with the olive oil throughout this dish for the best flavor and texture. I estimate that I use 1/2 cup total in this dish, but it's probably more. You're going to arrange 4 to 6 sheets of phyllo around the pan, draping each across the bottom and letting the extra hang off over the side of the pan. Drizzle with olive oil and then rumple 2 to 3 sheets of phyllo, one at a time, so that they just cover the bottom of the pan. Drizzle with olive oil, arrange 1/2 of the spinach mixture across the bottom, and then scrunch 4 to 6 sheets of phyllo, think hamburger shaped, and arrange over the spinach. Drizzle with olive oil, and then spoon the remaining spinach mixture evenly over these scrunched sheets. Fold the parts of the phyllo sheets draped over the sides of the pan over the spinach filling one at a time. You're going to drizzle this closed top with more olive oil. One at a time, rumple the remaining sheets so that they fit over the top of the pan. Every layer or two, you're going to drizzle with more olive oil and finish with a final drizzle of olive oil. You're going to use a sharp serrated knife to cut the spanakopita into serving size squares. Bake in preheated oven for 45 to 60 minutes until the top is very crispy and nicely browned. Let cool on a rack for 15 minutes before serving. You will need to cut it again, most likely, but it won't mess up the pastry very much since you've done it at the beginning. Leftovers keep for 1 week in the fridge. They could also be frozen. And then to reheat from the fridge, you're going to place uncovered in a 350-degree oven until it's warmed through and the pastry is crisp again, about 15 to 20 minutes. Notes: for the spinach, you can use fresh or frozen spinach. If you're using frozen, you'll need roughly 1 1/2 10-ounce packages, so each package is equivalent to 1 pound fresh. You want it defrosted and squeeze out any liquid when you do. And as far as the phyllo or phyllo, short of making your own from scratch, truly not as scary as it sounds, but that posts for another day, you'll want to buy it prepared. It usually comes frozen, and most packages will tell you to defrost it in the fridge for a day before using. Phyllo pastry comes in many thicknesses. Julie recommended number 7, which is thicker than I could get, so I got number 4. All of them will work, but there might be fewer sheets of a thicker in one in a 1 pound package, and this is totally and completely fine. But when there is a range in the recipe, like crumple 4 to 6 sheets, you will use the lower number for a thicker phyllo. Thank you for joining us for Food and Stuff, read by Gretchen Miller.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.